Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Deirdre Shuley, your host on Topically Yours, joining my cyberspace audience for another episode of Entertainment, where we bring topical conversation, interesting guests, and sometimes travel down memory lane with our celebrity guests to learn about their lives, their careers, and their mindsets. And today I'm happy to welcome to the show an award-winning artist who has been singing since a young child and is well-known throughout the world. I don't know. I think anyone hearing his song today does not recognize Wonderful, Wonderful and who our guest is, because he has such a distinctive and beautiful voice. And his voice is synonymous with romance. His discography includes jazz, traditional pop, Brazilian and Spanish music, soul, R&B, soft rock, Broadway standards, blues, disco tunes, ballads, traditional Christmas songs, and most recently, some Western tunes, country and Western tunes. And although Johnny Mathis began his career singing standard singles, he is better known as an album artist, having achieved gold and platinum status. He has sold over 350 million records worldwide, and Johnny Mathis was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame, received the Lifetime Achievement Award in 2003 by the Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, and received several Grammy Awards. His hit duet, The Last Time I Felt Like This, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Song. And Mr. Mathis has his own star in the Walk of Fame. And in 2007, he was inducted into the Hit Parade Hall of Fame. And, well, I'm delighted to have Mr. Mathis join us today to talk about, among other things, his upcoming engagement in New York, specifically in the Bronx at Lehman Center for the Performing Arts, where he'll be performing on Saturday, May 21st at 8 p.m. So we'd love to welcome you to the show, Johnny Mathis. How are you?
Well, thank you very much. My life just flashed in front of my face when you mentioned all that stuff. In fact, some of it I didn't realize that what was going on at the time. But thank you very much for having me on your program, and hello to all your wonderful listeners.
And it's the entire world listening, so we're delighted, and I mean, totally delighted to have you because you've had such a fascinating life. I was thinking about that when I was reading some of your background. Has there been a book written on you, or if not, have you ever considered writing a book on your life story?
Well, you know, when you write a book, you have to go around and publicize it and do all sorts of, interviews.
Promotion.
And what have you. And I've kind of avoided that for this long. Someday probably, just to make sure that it, you know, that whatever I did in my life is reproduced accurately, I'll probably have to sit down and write a book. But so far, I haven't. I've just been content to live my life and not to worry about writing about what's gone on before. A lot of it has been documented, of course, because I started out at such a young time in my life. Actually, I started out as on the college tour as a high jumper and a hurdler, and that was my big claim to fame. I hung around with a lot of wonderful, extraordinary people who became super athletes. The one that comes to mind is Bill Russell, and Bill and I went to school at the same time, not the same school, but we went to school at the same time in San Francisco, and we became friends, and did a lot of went to a lot of track meets together, and competed in the high jump, and then along came. During that time, I had also studied voice because my dad was a good singer, and he liked to listen to me sing. And
was he in vaudeville? I read somewhere where he had been in vaudeville. Is that true?
Well, he may have done some performances, but he got married and started a family so early that I doubt that he had any success as a vaudeville performer. But he was good enough to do that, I'm sure.
Is that how he made his livelihood?
No. My dad did just ordinary work that most people do who have a family and anything that he could make a living at doing. He was a house painter. I remember going on some of the job sites with my dad, and my job was to scrape all the old paint off the house, and he would come along and inspect it and paint the house, whatever color he was going to do it. I love my dad. My dad was my best friend. My mom, of course, also. But I come from a large family, and people think it's a little surprising that I feel that way about my parents. But they were so active and so wonderful, raising seven children, and so I really I miss them, you know, because we were close friends, and of course they were very instrumental in my becoming a singer.
I was about to ask you that because actually you had two wonderful things happen to you at the same time, an opportunity to go to the Olympic trials while at the same time being offered a record contract. Was that a difficult decision for you?
Well, you know, when you're an athlete, you're always kind of hurting. Something hurts, your back hurts or your leg hurts, and that's kind of the way it was when I went to the trials as a high jumper. Actually, the trials were held at the University of California in Berkeley. And during the same day, actually, that I was to go to the trials, I wasn't feeling very good. And along came this telegram from an executive from Columbia Records that if I wanted to go to New York, I would have to leave the following day and make my first recording. And that was the best news I had ever heard in my life. Came at such a great time because I really was dreading the fact that I was going to have to participate in the Olympic trials when I wasn't really feeling that great.
Well, I understand you were good at basketball, too.
Well, I was, you know, when you're in school and you're good at one thing, everybody thinks that you can you do something else too. And I wasn't that great at basketball. I wasn't tall enough, first of all. But I did win some awards as a team member at my high school and occasionally at San Francisco State University.
Well, I also want to mention you were born in Texas, right, Gilmer, Texas? But did you move to San Francisco very early on?
Yeah, my dad moved the family from Texas when I was about 4 years old.
That must have been a big change from Texas to California.
Well, it was. I was a little barefoot kid running around my grandparents' house. My parents had a tiny little house next to my grandparents' big house. And, of course, over the years, I did get a chance to go back and see my grandmother's house. And it wasn't big at all. But I thought it was when I was a little kid. It looked like it was when I was a little kid. But my grandparents played a very big role in taking care of me and my sister while my dad and my mom went to California with two of my older brothers and sisters. So it was, I come from a really responsible family, and it sort of has rubbed off on me. My brothers and sisters and I are all very, very close-knit family. We have a good, solid, wonderful remembrance of our parents who were just, I can't stress enough, because I know a lot of people don't have that luxury of you know, having good parents and what have you, but we were so lucky, and they permeated our lives, and anything that we've done after that is a reflection of their guidance.
Well, wasn't it your dad that saw your talent and even bought a piano for you, or at least brought a piano into the house?
My dad, yes, was at the time what he was doing was painting houses and what have you. And he came home one afternoon after his work, and he had a lot of what we thought was a bunch of lumber, and it turned out to be a dismantled piano. And he had it in the back of his car, and he took it all out and started, rumbling around in the front room. And before we knew it, there was a piano that was erected there. And then, miracle of miracles, he sat down and started playing it for the first time. We had no idea that my dad could do that. And it was kind of a revelation. And then, of course, the piano in that room and my dad sitting at the piano singing was a big part of our growing up after that.
And he also made sure that you got voice lessons and so forth. I understand you also have a bit of an operatic background.
Yeah, well, athletics is good in one thing, that it teaches you, you know, discipline.
Operatic background.
Operatic. Oh, operatic. Yeah. Well, my teacher was a wonderful opera singer. I studied with a woman. We did go around the San Francisco area and look for a voice teacher from the time I was about 8 years old or 9 years old. My dad thought it would be fun for me to study. And eventually, by the time, and we found a few people who were interested in helping me, but the structure wasn't there. And it wasn't until I was 13 years old that we met a lady who agreed to teach me voice lessons. We didn't have any money, but I did odd jobs for her and cleaned her apartment and cleaned her studio, and she gave me voice lessons. Her name was Connie Cox. And she was a lady who had appeared in a few films and had made her livelihood up until that time as a singer of light opera, and then she became a teacher, and I was one of her first students, and of course she taught me free of charge in between her paying students. And that is the reason that I learned to sing at an early age. And fortunately, because she was such a good teacher, I learned proper technique so that over all these years, I've never had any major problems with my voice. I think I think that's the thing that most singers are concerned about. You know, will I be able to sing, you know, all my life? And so far I have.
Well, and most beautifully, I must say, as I mentioned earlier to you, I grew up on your singing. My mother she played Ave. It was Ave Maria. She played that forever.
When I finally had a few hit recordings, I had some stature at my record company, and they allowed me to record more or less along with things that they wanted me to record that they thought were important. They let me record anything that I wanted to, and one of the first things I wanted to do was to record some Christmas music, and I did that in honor of my mom and my dad, who always made Christmas so special for my large family. And then the next project that I had was some religious music, not so much for my mom and my dad, but just I've always had this kind of universal feeling about the universe and the people who are religiously and who are spiritually guided. And I sang all the music. I recorded all the songs that I had heard in the Catholic Church that I went to, also the temples that I went to with some of my Jewish friends, and music that I heard in gospel music. And so I sort of put it all together in one album, and you mentioned the Ave Maria. We did the Bakuno Ave Maria and the Schubert Ave Maria, and lo and behold, it became a kind of a touchstone of my life, because a lot of people, as you have mentioned, love that music, and I'm very happy to hear that's one of your favorites.
Well, that and Secret Love.
Yeah.
Oh, I learned all the words to that, because we were so interracial family, and at that time, people were not as nice to us, so we were sort of like only within our own family unit. So
mm-hmm.
You were like a member of the family, because we played your music. I don't know why my mother was in love with Hawaiian music, but it was Hawaiian music and Johnny Mathis.
I liked Hawaiian music, too. As a matter of fact, my voice teacher used to go to Hawaii on holiday, maybe once a year, and she would always come back with this Hawaiian music. And I got accustomed to hearing Hawaiian music at an early age. Never fell in love with it too much, but I was aware of it.
Exactly. I never fell in love with it. We appreciated it.
Yeah.
But we loved you.
Thank you.
You were like a member of the family. We played you so much. But I also wanted to know, when you first started off, were you 19 years old when you got the record contract, or 18 years old?
I was 19, yes.
How was that? That was a life change, right? Because did you go to New York by yourself, or your family went with you?
I went by myself.
When you got your record contract?
Yeah.
Was that a major change? That was a major change in your life, correct?
It was a revelation. I had never gone beyond my the little trips that I took with Bill Russell, high jumping, and we went up and down the California coast to the different universities to participate in these track meets. But other than that, I had no idea about the big, wide, wonderful world out there. And then to leave my little confines in California, kind of a rural time, because we were always outdoors, and to go to New York, it was a big, big jump for me, psychologically and otherwise. And, right in the middle of Manhattan was where the studios were. And I went there with one thing in mind, and that was to make my recordings. And I remember spending hours and hours and hours in this little hotel room that I had, studying my music, and kind of not really knowing how to handle a big city like that. But it was something, and I will say that the only reason that I think that it really happened for me was I met along the way some people who befriended me and showed me around and got me accustomed to being in an environment that I was not accustomed to.
Well, how has the music business changed since back then? Were the record companies more protective of their artists, and or did the artists call the shots?
Oh no, we were like little puppets. we did whatever they told us to, because first of all, most people when they start their career are very young, and I knew how to do one thing, and that was sing, but I had no idea how to do anything else, and especially in a situation where you're dealing with a corporation, I didn't know who was who or what I was supposed to do other than go to the studio, meet the musicians that I was working with, and get some kind of what they call product. I did it, and I wasn't quite sure whether I did it right, and I wasn't quite sure that I did it the way they wanted me to. And it was it's always a mystery. I'd record, but I wouldn't hear it. I'd hear it back in the studio, and then I never knew what happened to the records. Sometimes I think it was about a year before I heard my first recordings, so that I could actually sit down and listen to what I had done. And some of it was really not good at all, but it was, at least it was dynamic, because my voice as a youngster, I had a terrific range, vocal range, and that was the thing that most people were kind of excited about. But it wasn't under control. I had no idea what I was doing. I was trying to impress. I was 19 and trying to sing every note that I could as loudly and hold the notes. I was trying to incorporate all the things that I had learned in voice lessons onto my...
Bill you initially as a romantic singer?
Oh, no. No, I was a jazzer. I was... Yeah, I was going to be the next great jazz singer. But I wasn't good at improvising, and I... But all my favorite singers were jazz singers. Ella Fitzgerald, Thurl Vaughan, Billy Eckstein, Nat King Cole. And I always thought of them as jazz singers. And they were, of course, great improvisers because they were great musicians. And I was not a great musician. I was just a kid who learned how to sing. Fortunately, all the romantic stuff came when I got a chance to make some single records, because there were two different animals. The person who took care of the album was a different person who took care of the single department. And so once I got the ear of the guy who was in charge of singles, who was Mitch Miller, then I got some exposure as a romantic singer. But the guy who signed me to my record contract was George Avakian, and George was my mentor at Columbia Records, and he was the head of jazz, and he wanted me to be a jazz singer. But of course, I ended up being not at all a jazz singer.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, you sing almost every genre of music. Do you have a particular genre that you prefer over others, or no?
I'm kind of partial to Broadway musicals.
Oh.
Because there's so much that hasn't been done. Every time I decide to change a song on my concert, I always go back to this wealth of books that I have here at the house, that over the years some of my friends who have given me advice about what is available to sing, some of the music that Cole Porter and Richard Rodgers and the Hammersteins and I could go on and on and on, hasn't been recorded, and I've recorded an awful lot of it along the way, but there's so much more left, and it's very interesting music, because they had a plot to develop, and so there are introspective songs, and there are fun songs, all kinds of music, and I never get tired of looking through these books and looking at the lyrics, and then finding out if there's a record available that I can listen to that, and it's a whole world that I hope that some of the young people who are interested in making music a bigger part of their lives, I hope they don't forget about that. The Broadway musicals of the, the 40s, the 30s, the 50s, the 60s, so much music available.
Real music.
Yeah, well, structured music that is different from what they hear daily on the radio, yeah.
Well, and you like singing before orchestras, I see.
Well,
do you like a big orchestra, a big band? Go ahead.
I have, over the years, utilized singing with a big orchestra because it was available to me. But lately on my concert shows, I brought my guitar player, Gil Rigers, who is a wonderful guitar player, and he and I have been working together for over 40 years, and I brought him out front, and I would say that the second half of my concert performances now consists of Gil and I singing at least five or six songs out in front, and the audience just loves it because they can hear my voice in a very pristine way, and not too much clutter, and I'm able to sing some pretty literate lyrics, and get them to listen to it, and they're just they really take to it, and it's a very big part of my performance now.
Well, I'm certainly going to take to it on May 21st at 8 o'clock, and I want to announce that to the folks that Johnny Mathis is going to be singing in the Bronx at Lehman Center for the Performing Arts, which is located at 250 Bedford Park Boulevard West. And those of you that want to ride the train, you can take the D and the number 4 train to Bedford Park stop. And drivers, you can get to the venue by way of Sawmill Parkway and Major Deacon Expressway. And parking is free. And also, I encourage you to rush, and I mean rush to the box office, because we don't know how long tickets for the great Johnny Mathis are going to be there. So you can call the box office at 718-960-8833 or go online at Lehman, that's L-E-H-M-A-N, Center, C-E-N-T-E-R.org, and purchase tickets. So I also want to ask you, you're going to be on the East Coast, so while you're here, are you going to sing at all in the metropolitan area, New Jersey, Connecticut, or PA, or Pennsylvania, or are you just going to go back home after the engagement, or are you touring a bit?
There is an engagement prior to my coming to the Bronx in the Pennsylvania area, and I can't remember the venue, but I have been on the East Coast for the first 3 or 4 months of this year, and I've sung up and down the coast, and I you know, it's such a big area, that tri-state area, you know, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, around that area, and I'm constantly making appearances there. So if they check the internet and check their local newspapers, they'll probably find that I'm going to be singing in the area, and I'm looking forward to this performance because it gets me right into the neighborhood, and I get a chance to see a part of New York that I never saw while I was living in Manhattan. You know, going to the Bronx, that was miles and miles away. So it took all this time for me to get there, but I'm looking forward to the performance.
Well, we appreciate it. I'm a Bronxite, so we appreciate when you come and visit us and certainly perform for us. I also wanted to ask you about when you first became a so-called or a celebrity. You are a celebrity. How did that change your life? Was that a shock?
Well, I've always been a little reticent, a little person who kind of a not a recluse, but I've always been a very private person and very respectful of the position that you know that this music has put me in. So I was always very careful with my public persona, and that. You know, that's always been a kind of a very important part of being able to be in the public eye and yet still have some semblance of reality, because that is kind of a make-believe world, and it you know, you can get caught up in it a little too much. Fortunately, as I mentioned so often, my parents gave me a pretty good idea about reality, and also about, you know, about the fantasy world that sometimes music can bring about. So I've had a very basic, fundamental, good foundation to build my career on, and it is. And it's all because of the people along the way that I've met who loved my music and also were interested in me as a person. And I've taken the good qualities that I've met, that I admire about a lot of people, and a lot of people that I've met in the entertainment business who are not only wonderful, wonderful performers of great music, but they're also wonderful people when you get to know them. So I've always thought that that was kind of a big deal to not only, you know, be able to do something well, but to, you know, have a good solid foundation in, you know, the real world also.
Well, you know, I just finished talking to the son of Ray Charles Robinson Jr., and he talked about his father's drug habit and his own as well as that of other artists. And he said that he thought that many artists take drugs because of insecurity and the pressure. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yes, I've gone through all sorts of times in my life where I've gotten involved with drugs and alcohol and what have you, and that's all because I was so shy in the beginning, and you're catapulted into this world where you're in front of people, and all the expectations that are, you know, that you think, and so you can absolutely, if you don't have some sort of semblance of reality to fall back on. In other words, the people that you associate with are very important so that they can get you out of these little situations that you eventually will. And everybody who is involved in any kind of, you know, life where you have to, you know, deal with public going in front of people and performing, and yeah, there's so many expectations, and if you're not, you know, if you're not psychologically suited to that, then you look for an escape. And yes, I've gotten over all of my things. I've gone through rehab for alcohol, you know, abuse, and fortunately came out the other side. And but I had the help of so many people who cared about me, and yeah, it's a very, very difficult kind of life that we've chosen to live, and it requires a lot of help from a lot of people.
Well, is it the pressure of always having to top the last record, to always bring something better than the next? And it's that seems to me that that's sort of an impossibility, that to be perfect every single time. There has to be a lot of pressure to constantly deal with that, and also to know who your real friends are.
Yeah, you're walking around, you know, and you know your situation in the world, and yet you still are basically in front of the little person who is guessing at what to do and hoping that you please people. And it's a very, you have to have a lot of help along the way from people who have gone through it and who can give you advice as to what is important and what is not. And then you finally, you start taking away all of the stuff that doesn't matter, and also you know, in your mind you conjure up all these fantasies and things that about reality that don't even matter, and you end up, if you're lucky enough, to get back to basic fundamental. This is what I do. And in order to do it, I have to be physically capable of doing it, which requires me to take care of myself and to get proper rest, nutrition, exercise, and if you're lucky enough, as I have been, you come out with a wonderful career and looking forward to other aspects of life that that come along with being being the person that you are, that people really admire you for, you know, for getting through all the pitfalls and what have you. And
doesn't it take a lot of courage and strength to get through all of that? I mean, that's something within the inner core of yourself.
Yes, it does. And most people, make up their minds about who you are and what you are and the way they think about you. And you're the only person who knows the reality of what you are. And if you can find a wonderful place for yourself that you're comfortable in, that's the greatest thing that could ever happen to you, because it's wonderful to have a career, but it's only good if you're comfortable in it. If you're uncomfortable in it, you're going to make mistakes along the way, and you'll never be happy. You have to find a way to
find that moment of happiness.
Yes, absolutely.
That place of happiness. And if you don't mind, sir, I want to play Too Much, Too Little, Too Late.
Oh, good, with my friend Denise.
I love that song, too. And then I want to come back and talk to you about one of your loves, which is cooking.
Okay.
So here we go with Johnny Mathis singing Too Much, Too Little, Too Late.
Yes, it's over, call it a day. Sorry that it had to end this way. No reason to pretend, we knew it had to end someday. This way.
For you alone?
I did, yes. actually, I didn't write it. What I did, the people who publish books for public education asked me if I would look at the recipes and give them my take on them. And I did, and I agreed with most of them. The whole idea behind the little book was that it's kind of difficult to cook for one person because you have a lot of stuff left over, and you have it's kind of putting together small meals, and I thought that was a good idea because I've done it all my life. And, you know, and when I get carried away, I end up with food for an army. So it's kind of a nice guide for people who want to cook only for themselves. It's been out of print for a very long time, though. It's one of those things that's a collector's item now.
Well, do you have any particular food that you are special? Is your specialty?
Well, you know what I've learned over the years, because fortunately I do get a chance to meet some people who spent their lives preparing food. My mom and dad were professional cooks for many of their years, and I learned basic fundamental cooking techniques, cleaning up as you go along, utilizing, the same utensils over and over again and what have you. And I learned a lot from my mom and dad, but I also got to meet extraordinary people like Julia Child and Paul Prudhomme and some extraordinary people who spend their lives cooking. And what I came down to is to go into a market and find out what looks good, what's in season, and learning how to prepare it. Because that way you get a little diversity instead of cooking and eating the same thing over and over again, because the seasons change, and as the seasons change, foodstuffs are available. So it's a learning process that I've enjoyed all my life. I still cook all my own food, and it's a matter of finding the time to do it. I have a routine now that I go through. I get up at 5 in the morning, and for the last 20 years I've been going to the gym, and I spend an hour or an hour and a half at the gym, and then coming back home I stop at the market and get whatever food I have to have for my dinner. That's my main meal. I don't really worry too much about anything other than having a meal, about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, and I get my preparation, and then I come home and prepare everything so that it's a little quick fix before I before I finish the day, and then I can go off and play golf all day and come home.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because you are an avid golfer, are you not? Even sponsored some tournaments.
I think you'd call it addiction. Yeah, golf. Golf is one of those things that people get addicted to, and it's a lot of my friends that I've had over the years have have absolutely lost their wives and their husbands because they spend so much time on the golf course. I play at least 5. Probably 6 times a week, all the time. And
wow.
I never get
but
tired.
But you've also
of it.
Sponsored tournaments, I've understood, like in Britain and Ireland and even in the USA.
Yeah, golf is one of those international games where the rules are the same whether you're in Scotland or in, Santa Monica. Everybody plays by the same rules. And when you travel, as I do, you get a chance to meet people who play. The only thing that's different are the golf courses in Great Britain. you know, the golf courses are quite different from the way they are over here. So, yeah, I get a chance to meet people and to chase that little white ball around all over the world.
Well, you know, times are changing, but at one time you didn't see too many African Americans playing golf. Do you sponsor or help youth introduce them to the sport of golf or anything like that in your humane pursuits?
The only thing that I've done in that regard over the years is to support my track and field team at my alma mater, my San Francisco State University. And we have an annual track meet there every year, and I've been sponsoring the meet over 30 years. Because the funds for things like that are not available anymore, so they need outside people helping. And of course, that was a big part of my life, track and field. So I do support that aspect of it. And then as long as young people get a chance to have some sort of get to
opportunity.
Know, yeah, opportunity for sports that are that are available. They go from one to the next to the next, I'm all for that. I over the years I've spent a lot of time trying to get young people involved in instructed athletics, because it's a good thing, and it's usually
gets them off the street.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now you sang in the Reagan White House, the Bush White House, but have you had a chance to sing at all in the Obama, Barack Obama White House yet?
Oh, about 12 years ago. Well, maybe less than that. It was about 2 years before Obama was elected. I sang for a very wealthy man who gives parties all the time, and he asked me if I would sing for a gathering that he had of about 60 people he was having over for dinner, and it was at a lovely little house that he had, and right outside of San Francisco. And it turns out that he's the owner and chairman of the board of Oracle. I can't remember his name right now, because I've sung for a lot of private situations. And I sang, and I got to sing because David Foster, who is a wonderful musician and has been responsible for a lot of great, talented young people, David asked me if I would sing, and I did. And they introduced, at the end of my performance, they introduced me to the people that I sang for. Because otherwise I was downstairs in the basement, and they said, okay, come on up and sing. And I'd sing, and sometimes you never get a chance to meet the people that you're singing for, but they just tell you who they are. And it was Mr. Obama.
Wow.
Was the person that I was singing for, and it was just one of those little get-togethers that people do for people who are interested in public service. And it turned out that I had sung for him, Barack Obama, and didn't even realize it until he became president. I said, I know him.
Well, what do you think of his decision not to show the pictures of the assassination of Osama bin Laden? I think that's a wise decision, but what do you think?
I go along with it, absolutely. It's one thing to to do what you do, and in a situation like this, where it could easily inflame people if they see pictures of their martyrs, splashed across the newspaper. I just don't think, as they said, I think they used the phrase, "That's just not us. We don't go."
I agree. It's not. Why inflame? I agree with you. Why inflame? It's just not us. And, you know, just having Obama in the White House, to me, is like once upon a dream.
Oh, absolutely.
I
remember Oprah Winfrey jumping up and down when that happened. And it's like how could this happen? You know, because it didn't seem seemly at the time, and then all of a sudden he came along and captured everybody's imagination, and it's wonderful. Greatest thing that ever happened in my lifetime.
Exactly. To see an African American in the White House, I mean, it gives you faith, it gives you encouragement, and I think it's a good thing for African American youth, and not just African American youth, all people of color, to see that we can achieve and rise to the highest state of the land.
Absolutely. And it also gives people of other colors, you know, to say, well, you know, they're not so bad. You may change their idea for the rest of their lives about people that they had the misconceptions about.
And if you don't mind, I want to play another song for my audience called "Once Upon a Dream."
Okay.
Here we go.
When this all began, we knew there'd be a prize. Once upon a dream, we were lost in love. There we'd found a perfect place. Once upon a dream, once there was a time like no other time before. Hope was still an open door. Once upon a dream, and I was unafraid. The dream was so exciting, but now I see it fade, and here I am alone. Once upon a dream, you were heaven sent to me. Was it never meant to be? Was it just a dream? Could we begin? Upon a dream.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mathis, for allowing me to play the music, because I also have a show in Sweden. And they are a music show, so I want to send this show there as well on soulinterviews.com.
Okay, thank you.
And also, I have two more questions, and then we'll call this a day, although I could talk to you all day. But I know, and I mentioned before, that you have won many awards, and met many, and you said it yourself, met many famous people and heads of state, and certainly you have left and are leaving volumes of music that will outlast you forever. But what do you feel is your greatest accomplishment to date as a person?
Oh, gosh, you know, along the way, I've met some extraordinary people who have helped me a great deal. And I always felt that if I could do something for somebody to take away a lot of the anxiety that people have about all sorts of things, I could make a difference in one person's life. Because as I travel along and I meet people who come to my concerts and tell me how much my music has changed their lives or meant to their lives, and then and to be able to respond to them and to give them some degree of satisfaction about what they perceive is some of about some of this music that they've heard. It makes me understand the importance of doing something that is important. Little things that may change people's lives forever. And over the years, I thought that the introduction would be from my music, but the final result would come from the contact, the physical and the contact that I have with people after they get over the the wherewithal of he's a celebrity and that. The people that I've met that have really influenced me the most were people who had these great abilities and yet maintained their dignity.
Wow, that's great. That's beautiful. And how would you like to be remembered when it's all said and done? What would you like the world to say of you?
Well, the most obvious thing is that people are going to remember you by your music, because that's the thing that they connect with. The name Johnny Mathis is oh yeah, he's a singer, and somewhere along the way I got very comfortable with the music that I've been able to sing, and as long as they listen to that music and kind of fantasize about what they're hearing, they'll get a pretty good idea about me and what I think is important in life. Because there's no way that I could really sing with any conviction music that doesn't really touch my heart, and so that's what I've done. I've avoided songs that maybe could have given me a little bit more notoriety or something. But I've certainly only along the way, and I've been able to do it, because when you work, for a corporation like a big record company, you're obligated to listen to their, their wishes and what have you, as far as what you're going to do. But I've been able to sing the music that really touches my heart, and I think that the listening audience will get a good idea about my life and what I think is important just by listening to the songs that I've chosen to sing.
Well, you've been with Columbia Records for almost ever. For a short stint with Mercury Records, you've been with Columbia forever, and I guess they've been a good partnership.
60 years. Yeah. And the, you know, the hierarchy at these record companies changes constantly, all the time. And to be able to, you know, to have a relationship with a big company like that for all these years is really amazing. I don't know how it's been done, but the gods have guided
the power
it.
Of your voice.
Maybe.
The power of your music.
Maybe.
There's no one like Johnny Mathis.
Oh, boy, you're a fan, aren't you?
You know it. I told you we grew up with your music. I'm a big, big fan. And my mother will be so proud of me that I talked to you. Because that's like a little country girl talking to the great Johnny Mathis. She's going to be shocked. But I thank you so, so very much for coming on the show today and sharing your life, your music, and your mind, and who you are as truly Johnny Mathis, and not the image, but the man.
Thank you very much.
You know, it's certainly been my pleasure sharing this time with you, Mr. Mathis. But at last, it's come to an end. So I thank you for coming on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul, and sharing your music and life. And also, I want to remind the folks again that Johnny Mathis will be at Lehman Center for the Performing Arts in the Bronx. And again, I encourage listeners to run to the box office while tickets are left, and they're not that many, I understand. And you can call the box office number at 718-960-8833 or go online at lehmancenter.org. And the show again is on May 21st. That's Saturday, May 21st at 8 p.m. And, well, I thank my audience for making my topic topically yours, and I'm going to sign off. This is Deirdre Shuler thanking Johnny Mathis for gracing
our
show today.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, happy Mother's Day.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're going to end the show with Chances Are. Bye, all.
Deirdre?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. I hope I can get to see you backstage, but I'll see if that happens.
Okay. Make it. Try to get in touch with Gil, my guitar player, Gil Rodriguez. You'll see him out front playing with me, and he's the guy backstage that gets me to meet everybody, okay?
His name is Gil Ryder?
Gil Rodriguez, yeah.
Ryder. Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much, Mr. Mann.
Okay, no, bye-bye.
Bye.
Just because my composure sort of slips the moment that your lips meet mine, chances are you think my heart's your valentine. In the magic of moon, when I sigh, hold me close, dear. Chances are you believe the stars that fill the skies are in my eyes. Guess you feel you'll always be the one and only one for me. Are awfully good. Chances are you believe the stars that fill the sky. Me. And if you think you could, well, chances are your chances are awfully good.
And for those of you that did not hear the show live, you can catch it on the BlakeRadio.com, Rainbow Soul Archives, or hear it on SoulInterviews.com. And I think I will send it there in July. All right? So I'm going to play one more song and then we're gone. And that's Windmills of My Mind, sung by Johnny Mathis. So you can also download the show on your Android.
Wound, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never
and cell
ending
phone.
Or beginning, on an ever spinning wheel, like a snowball down a mountain or a carnival balloon. Like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon. Like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face. And the world's like an apple whirling silently in space. Like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Like the tunnel that you follow to a tunnel of its own, down a hollow to a cavern where the sun has never shone. Like a door that keeps revolving in a half-forgotten dream, or the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream. Like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face. And the world is like an apple whirling silently in space. Like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walk along a shore and leave their footprints in the sand. Is the sound of distant drumming just the fingers of your hand? Pictures hanging in a hallway and the fragments of a song. Half remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, you were suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the color of her hair. Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever-spinning wheel. As the images unwind, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
You can download this show with Johnny Mathis on Skitcher.com on your cell phone. Go to iTunes on podcasts and the Blake Radio Network.com, Rainbow Soul.